Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson, and welcome to the Defending the Constitution series of essays. This essay addresses one of the most persistent and wrong-headed criticisms of the Constitution, the claim that it was adopted to protect or at least accommodate slavery. As explained below, that criticism is historically false. The critics point out that perhaps 25 of the Constitution's 55 framers or drafters were slaveholders. But this statistic is deceptive. One reason it's deceptive is that it omits a countervailing factor. The Constitutional Convention also included influential opponents of slavery. John Dickinson inherited bondsmen, but freed them all. Benjamin Franklin, James Wilson, and Gouverneur Morris, among others, were abolitionists. And even among the minority who held slaves, some, such as James Madison, favored gradual emancipation. As a result, there was much criticism of slavery at the Constitutional Convention, and only the South Carolina delegates offered even a tepid defense. Another reason the statistic is deceptive is that the framers comprised only a tiny segment of the founders. Far more numerous were the 1,648 state convention delegates who actually converted the Constitution into law, more when you add the 1791 ratification by Vermont, and the overwhelming majority of those delegates did not own slaves. Additionally, most leading participants in the ratification debates were not slaveholders. For example, Noah Webster, later famous as the author of the first great American dictionary, was an abolitionist. Additionally, there were tens of thousands of voters who selected the state convention delegates. Perhaps 95% of those voters owned no slaves. During the founding generation, most thoughtful people in the English-speaking world believed that slavery violated natural law. Indeed, the English-speaking peoples were the first major demographic group in history to abolish the institution of slavery. This process was well underway when the Constitution was written. Thus, in 1772, the Court of King's Bench in England decided the case of Somerset versus Stuart, which banished slavery from the English homeland. Soon after American independence, 10 of the 13 states abolished the slave trade, and one, North Carolina, imposed steep taxes upon it. Several states also began general emancipation. Five granted the vote to free African Americans. That's why Constitutional Convention delegate Roger Sherman of Connecticut remarked that, quote, "The abolition of slavery seems to be going on in the United States and that the good sense of the several states will probably by degrees complete it." And his Connecticut colleague Oliver Ellsworth, later Chief Justice of the United States, predicted that, quote, "Slavery in time will not be a speck in our country." Sherman and Ellsworth were expressing the common view that slavery in America was on the way to extinction. Tragically, those subscribing to that view didn't foresee the invention of the cotton gin. Despite the trends against slavery, it remained clear that the elite in a few states were clinging to it and wouldn't approve a constitution that curbed it. South Carolina delegate Charles Cotesworth Pinckney said, and I quote, "If himself and all his colleagues were to sign the Constitution and use their personal influence, it would be of no avail toward obtaining the assent of their constituents. South Carolina and Georgia cannot do without slaves." The framers were forced to conclude that a constitution curbing slavery couldn't unify the country and might even fail the 9-state ratification threshold. And unity was critical because the probable result of disunion would be never-ending war on the American continent. The common cause against Great Britain tied together colonies that previously never had much to do with each other. But by 1787, this connection was unraveling. The Confederation Congress was widely ignored. Rhode Island and Connecticut were in a creditor-debtor spat that threatened resort to arms. Many spoke of dividing the country into several confederations, with some states remaining entirely independent. On the costs of disunity, European history was instructive. The previous 150 years had witnessed about 70 European wars in addition to rebellions, and the results were horrific. The 30 Years' War, which ended in 1648, may have killed directly or indirectly as many as 8 million people. The War of the Austrian Succession resulted in perhaps 500,000 casualties. The 7 Years' War caused perhaps 1 million. Had a similar scenario been imported to America, it's likely that the slaves, because they were at the bottom of the social hierarchy, would have suffered from war even more than free people. That's why when Governor Edmund Randolph introduced his Virginia plan, he emphasized that the current system couldn't protect against foreign invasion, couldn't prevent states from provoking foreign powers, and couldn't prevent interstate conflict. To do that, a stronger government was necessary. During the public debates on the Constitution, an important part of the advocates' successful argument was the need for unity to avoid war. Although I believe modern writers rely too heavily on the Federalist Papers when searching for constitutional meaning, those essays do offer a good sample of the arguments for unity. John Jay, who had served as the Confederation's Foreign Secretary, wrote in Federalist No. 4, and I'm quoting here, "But the safety of the people of America against dangers from foreign force depends not only on their forbearing to give just causes of war to other nations, but also on their placing and continuing themselves in such a situation as to not invite hostility or insult, for it need not be observed that there are pretended as well as just causes of war. One government can collect and avail itself of the talents and experience of the ablest men," Jay went on, "in whatever part of the Union they may be found. It can move on uniform principles of policy. It can apply the resources and power of the whole to the defense of any particular part, and that more easily and expeditiously than state governments or separate confederacies can possibly do. But," Jay went on, "leave America divided into 13, or if you please, into 3 or 4 independent governments, what armies could they raise and pay? What fleets could they ever hope to have? If one was attacked, would the others fly to its succor and spend their blood and money in its defense?" In Federalist No. 5, Jay outlined the danger of warfare among the American states themselves, and in Federalist No. 6, Alexander Hamilton pressed that argument further. In number 41, Madison pointed out that European nations would intervene to turn American states against each other. Here's Madison speaking. "The fortunes of disunited America will be even more disastrous than those of Europe. The sources of evil in Europe are confined to her own limits. No superior powers of another quarter of the globe intrigue among her rival nations, inflame their mutual animosities, and render them the instruments of foreign ambition, jealousy, and revenge," end quote. Of course, all those things could have happened to America. Madison summarized in Federalist No. 45, quote, "The Union is essential to the security of the people of America against foreign danger and essential to their security against contentions among the different states." Before criticizing the founders for permitting the states to allow slavery, therefore, we must understand the choice they faced. Either, one, tolerating a vile institution that seemed to be dying away anyway, or, on the other hand, consigning the American continent to perpetual warfare at the cost of millions of lives and incalculable misery, both for free people and for slaves. Final observation. The woke crowd attacks the Constitution in part because some slaveholders advocated it. But slaveholders were at least as prominent among the Constitution's active opponents. So by the woke crowd's reasoning, their own criticism is tarred by anti-Federalist slaveholders, such as Virginia's Richard Henry Lee and North Carolina's Willie Jones. Finally, the claim that the founders should have abolished slavery at all costs, no matter how horrible the results, Ill becomes those who accept or even promote evils such as street violence, government attacks on freedom, and infanticide. Such people should reassess their own conduct before railing against the founders. I'm Rob Nadelson. Thanks for listening.